This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Back in and rolling on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN. You know what we do every Friday. We talk some Grizzlies with Parker Fleming. He's from Substack Elitist. His free Grizzlies and NBA draft Substack. Make sure you go subscribe. And if you support monetarily, all the support goes to St. Jude because he is a grade A human being. On X at, of course, Paka underscore Flocka. Parker, how's it going, brother?
Gabe, it is great to be on the Gabe Kuhn Show, the grade A show out there. I wish it was a little bit happier circumstances, but at the end of the day, we're still getting to talk about Grizzlies hoops, meaningful Grizzlies hoops, for better or for worse, and let's get into it.
Yeah, before we get into the negativity, I will say it felt like the feeling was restored before the game last night, at least in the lead up to the game, and even till halftime. You know, it was meaningful basketball, and I feel like everybody was on the edge of their seat the entire time.
Dude, that first half was one of the best displays of basketball and shot making that I've seen in a long – the game that I immediately go to when I think about that is that Brooklyn Nets game a few years ago where Ja, Dez, Kyrie, and KD all had like 35 or more each. But like between Ja, Ant, Bain, and Randall, it was just some like wicked shot making. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
Until the second half.
And we were texting back and forth in that first half. It is hilarious to think about that disgusting playoff series these two teams played against each other in 2022. And watching that first half, it was night and day. Second half, we'll get to that in a second. But it did remind me, and people did have to remind me, Dylan Brooks and D'Angelo Russell were a part of that series. So that's why that was stupid basketball. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of the amount of revisionist history people are doing about the teams of a few years ago and letting go of certain guys and all that, and Dylan Brooks being one of them. So.
Yeah, I hear you. I don't buy into those conversations very much. I try to stay out of those.
I don't either.
The thing with Dylan Brooks I don't get about the revisionist history around Dylan Brooks. Sure, yes, I can admit the Grizzlies need better perimeter defenders. They need a dog out there, and Dylan Brooks could provide that. But like at the time, we knew that that whole relationship had ran its course. I don't know why we have to revisit that and act like we weren't saying the things we were saying at that time. We were all in agreement. You know, you need to move forward. You need to find somebody who's less of a shot chucker. They haven't found that guy yet. They tried to do it with Marcus Smart. That didn't work out. But at the same time, it doesn't preclude them from being able to find that guy going into this offseason, going into the future.
100%. Yeah. And like I think me, you, and Connor were all higher on Dylan Brooks than most, if not all, of Grizzlies. Twitter, Nation, media, however you want to spin it. Just a lot of revisionist history. But let's not look at the past. Let's look at the present.
Let's look at the present. This is the way I explained it earlier on the show, Parker. I feel like the first half, we brought up great shot making, unbelievable basketball, ethical hoops, the whole thing. It was a sugar high, though. Let's be honest. It was a sugar high. 70% from the field is what the Grizzlies shot. They were 50% from three on the game, still lost. But, you know, the same things that have been ailing them since the All-Star break and the trade deadline ailed them in the first half. We just ignored it because they scored 72 points. And then in the second half, you get into the third quarter. Here's a franchise record, 52 points in a quarter for the Timberwolves. They shoot 18 for 21 from the field. Yeah, there was good shot making, but at the same time, there was a lot of warm-up jumpers from the three-point line. So it felt like the first half was a sugar high, and then the sugar crash came in the second half.
Yeah, and like I will say on the shot making, like Anthony Edwards did get, like, he is one of the most high frequent pick and roll players in the league. And now, and you know, we've said this on the show countless times about the pick and roll and how to leverage it. No player in the NBA, maybe, I think you can maybe count on one hand, like Luka, Tyrese Haliburton, maybe Trae Young. Actually, no. Luka and Tyrese Haliburton, in my opinion, that's it. Leverage the pick and roll better than Anthony Edwards, because he's either, if you come up on him, he's going to go right to the basket, or if you give him too much space, he's going to let it fly from three because he's added that pull-up three. It is by far the most like meaningful player development of the 2020 so far, because now it's like if Kobe Bryant like decided to master the three-point jumper instead of the mid-range jumper. Yep. Like, that's what this is like.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I think Julius Randle, there was about 7 of his 13 makes where I felt like they were kind of in his chest, and they put him in the phone box and he made tough shots and you just tipped your cap. But, you know, when you look at that second half and the plays that come out, stand out to me, it's like you have the over helping where it's like, oh crap. Well, here's 2 threes from Jaden McDaniels.
Yes.
Here's 2 threes. From Nikhil Alexander-Walker. Here's 3 threes from Dante DiVincenzo. And that's also part of the game right there. It's like, yeah, Randall and Edwards had 44 and 31, but you had 10 from McDaniels and 9 from DiVincenzo, 10 from Alexander-Walker, one of my favorite Grizzly targets for the summer, by the way. And the Grizzlies, like, they had 36 from Ja, 28 from Bane, 23 from Jaren. And after that, you just had 16 from Scottie Pippen. And that's it. Like, you know? And, like, that's where you kind of point to. It's like, okay, that lost the game. It's like you don't have – you're not only – your defense is not only struggling getting up these shots, but you're not getting enough firepower alongside your big three to
right.
to really sustain what's being thrown at you or yeah. withstand yeah. what's being thrown at
For
you.
For sure. They just couldn't get stops. And, you know, the bigs, Jaren and Zach Edey both – could not defend without fouling. We can argue back and forth all day about their whistle on the defensive end, but that's the truth of it. They can't defend without fouling in these big games, and that's been a struggle for them yep. all year. Now, I really – something I just struggle with mightily, whether it's been Taylor Jenkins or Tomas Asalo, I know they've lost players and good perimeter defenders. Marcus Smart, Jake LaRavia, Jalen Wells is now going to be out for the year. But – as much as we talk about those players being one of the big reasons they've had this fall off with their perimeter defense, there's just too many lapses. And that's something that just never seemingly happened before when Taylor Jenkins was coaching this team, now Tomas Asalo. It's just the amount of breakdowns is the thing that I just don't understand, because that is something that they've been pretty consistent with for the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And it's just all the way off now. And they have no semblance of where they should be placed on the floor. We can talk about the ability player to player all we want, but there's too many lapses.
Yeah, and it is tied to, if you're going to go back to, you know, past years, there is a difference in player personnel and who you're rolling with defensively, because, you know, if you go back to the 22-23 season, you had Dylan Brooks, a healthier Brandon Clark. You had Xavier Tillman, who, like, at least when he switched, he's keeping his guy in front of him.
Yep.
You had John Conchar playing rotation minutes, and everyone could say what they want about John Conchar. That dude's a plus defender. He is very
– he had good minutes plus. Last night. Very good.
He had good minutes. And if you stretch it back to 21-22, like, DeAnthony Melton, Kyle Anderson, Dylan Brooks, you had – at the end of the day, it all kind of boils down to you got to stay in front. You got to stay in front of your guy, because when that happens, it forces help. And then when you have the help, you also help the helper. And that's what leads to these seemingly wide open looks from downtown, or guys sneaking.
It leads to foul trouble for the bigs too. That ties in as well.
Yeah, exactly. Or even like a guy drives, Zach Edey has to step up, and then now somebody's sliding baseline, dump off pass, bucket or foul, because you're having to recover on the pass. So I do think a lot of it is personnel. And like, again, this isn't me trying to play revisionist history, because there's a reason why they walked away from Dylan Brooks, Kyle Anderson, DeAnthony Melton, because they couldn't hit shots when it mattered. So they need to find a way to – and I think Jalen Wells is a great start. He's a rookie, a great start, because he's going to hit shots and he's going to defend and keep his guy in front of him and be a plus defender on the league's best players. Now it's – because the best teams in the NBA have multiple bodies to throw at guys. I know Minnesota being in this mix doesn't quite highlight it, but they're a Western Conference Finals team last year.
Yep.
And between Ant, Alexander Walker, McDaniels – and then Gobert anchoring, you just had a lot of the floor shut down. I mean, look at Oklahoma City. They have a historic defense because they have littered their roster with players that are going to keep their guys in front of them. They're going to play physical. And like this, and that, I think that's just what it is right now. And, you know, at the beginning of the season, yeah, you had Jake Laravia. And again, I think a lot of revisionist history is being said about Marcus Smart and even Jake Laravia. Jake Laravia was a scapegoat for the franchise or for the fan base for 3 years.
Like, he was.
You know, like, and then Marcus Smart, he wasn't playing. Like, he's like, oh, it'd be great to have Marcus Smart. But yeah, but like Marcus Smart played 30 games out of a possible like 120. Like, what are we doing here? Like,
right.
I don't know. Like, yeah. The perimeter defense has slipped, and frankly, it's just one of those things that I think at this stage, especially without Brandon Clark and Jalen Wells, who have been two of their three best defenders that are available right now, it's just tough for me to foresee how can they fix their perimeter defense without real personnel change this offseason. And I'm not talking about – and also, too, like that also comes like with coaching. Like, you know, it's unfair to judge – Isolo based off of this stretch defensively, because he doesn't have the time.
They haven't had practices.
He can't implement a defensive system. And like, look, I'm confident he can still be the head coach next year, by the way. I don't think there's many candidates out there, even if you factor in Mike Malone or Mike Brown, or I think Isolo has the goods to take this team to the next level. It kind of reminds me of maybe like that Atkinson vibe, maybe like just from, and that's just from like what I've seen so far, but also YouTube dives off these content creators out in Europe that actually are there and have a history of watching Isolo. So that's just a different tangent, but yeah, I just think I don't think perimeter defense stuff is going to be shored up until the off season, quite frankly.
Isn't that the frustrating reality though? Because it's like for 4 or 5 years, you've been trying to find that perfect guy on the wing who can give you a really good defense, guard the other team's best player, but still knock down shots when he's asked to. You also don't want that guy to be too shot happy. Shout out to Dylan Brooks. We learned that the hard way. But you feel like you're back at square one, even though going into the season there was so much hope, right? Vince Williams Jr., G.G. Jackson, Scottie Pippen Jr. was a guy you signed long-term. You end up drafting Jalen Wells. Like, the same problems that you thought were going to be fixed, you thought you were going to be lousy with wings. You thought you were going to have a bunch of guys like that. You just don't. You don't. So this offseason, you have to go do the same thing, try to shop for the same things that you've been shopping for every single season since Zach Kleiman got here.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Well, I think Jalen Wells and Scottie Pippen Jr. have emerged as viable options going forward. Of like, hey, I want that guy guarding some of the opposing team's best players. Now it's a little bit unfair when you're having like, okay, like because of the situation right now with injuries, and in to be blunt, just the fact that Vince Williams and G.G. Jackson, like because of injuries, they haven't been able to kind of bring that magic that they had in the 24-25 season, you know? But it's one of those things, like, it's like, oh, man, I wish we didn't have to have Scottie Pippen Jr. guarding Jaden McDaniels or insert six eight guy,
right.
Scottie Pippen Jr. But, like, again, it's just, again, having multiple guys to throw, like, because a lot of these, the best teams, they're going to have at least two star-level creators on the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you need two-plus defenders to throw at these guys. And right now, with injuries and the state of the roster, they just don't have that right now.
Yep. Yep. That is the absolute truth. Now, instead of bringing up names, let's just eliminate names from this conversation. What's the type of coach that the Grizzlies should hire next? What's the type of coach that you look at?
This is a trick question, because I just said, like, I'm for hiring Ethelon.
Sure, sure. But let's, again, eliminate names.
Okay, eliminate names.
Type of coach.
A type of coach. Obviously, they need, I think every team needs a coach that's going to hold teammates accountable. But it's also like, you can hold teammates accountable without, like, being a jerk, you know? Like, being a guy that's going to end up rubbing guys the wrong way.
Let me not. I don't want to cut you off. There's this misnomer about holding Ja accountable that I think a lot of people outside of Memphis sort of miss the mark on. Like Chris Canty,
yeah.
I think it was yesterday on Unsportsmanlike, our morning show. He was talking about how you need to have a fire breather. I don't think that would work very well with Ja Morant. I think ultimately you need to bring in a coach that brings the best out of Ja Morant so he can hold himself accountable. I don't need a coach to just yell and scream and berate Ja at every turn, because ultimately what would that lead to? You saw what Michael Malone did eventually rubbing that Nuggets team the wrong way, and he gets fired.
Yep.
It's just like, you don't need that fire breather. I don't know if that jives with Ja Morant. I think eventually what we hope for is Ja can hold himself accountable. So I don't need a coach to come in here and just berate him every single day, tell him he's doing wrong, and be on his back the whole time, because he's already a guy who sort of feels victimized. Victimized by the league, victimized by the general public. I don't need a coach to come in where he could feel like he's victimized by his own coach. It just it feels 100%. Like that whole fire breather conversation, holding Ja accountable. I feel like everyone is missing the mark with that.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, another thing I was going to say with along those lines, you need a coach that holds people accountable, but they also have to be collaborative as well.
Sure,
the best teams are the ones, like, for example, Joe Mazzulla, he holds those guys accountable, but he's also collaborative with them. You need that collaboration with your star players. You need that collaboration with the front office. The best teams are in lockstep. And I know that's what Zach Kleiman has preached about, you know, this tenure, is making sure everyone's in lockstep on what the organizational goals are. And I don't think that's going to go away with this coaching search, or even with this stretch of adversity here. Obviously, you want a coach to find competitive advantages, not necessarily just do the same thing that everyone else does. Just find competitive advantages, get the best out of pieces that are going to alter your team's trajectory. Obviously, you got to maximize your core. Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, Jaren Jackson Jr. I think he's found it with Ja, and I've seen Desmond Bane shoot more threes lately. Jaren, I still think he's nursing the ankle to an extent, because he just hasn't been that same guy since coming back. But he's found something with Zach Edey. Like, the fact that Zach Edey has gone from being deemed unplayable to being a good center to have in your rotation at the very least. And so I think, and you could even say he's found something and found the best in Scottie Pippen Jr. as well, who was also playing really well before Taylor Jenkins was fired. But that's what you want. You want you want a coach that's going to be collaborative and also trying to identify competitive advantages that are giving your best team the chance to win. Again, I'm going to point to this guy because he's not available right now, but it's a good example of this. Joe Mazzulla, he identified the advantage. Like, you know what? We have this talent on our roster that any of these guys can attack the rim and, or put pressure on the paint, and they can pass, and they can shoot. We're going to shoot more threes than absolutely every single player.
Any franchise in the history of the NBA.
Any franchise ever. Where, like, the other, like, when they played Memphis, Memphis played them well, but they lost because they gave up 60 threes, and even hitting 33% of them is 21. Yes. That's what that is. That's what that is, Gabe. A competitive advantage. Same with OKC. They're like, hey, we're going to just – the refs can't call every – and in Houston, I haven't watched the video, but Ben Taylor from Thinking Basketball wrote about the Rodman offense where it's like, hey, we're just going to crash the offensive glass and get all these possessions. And it's just going to give us more opportunities to score and limit the possessions of the other team. And these teams also, they have these guys that are these physical defenders because guess what, Gabe? You can't call a foul on every possession, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're going to get leeway just for the sake of you can't call fouls on every possession. And they have guys that have the reputation of being physical defenders. And when you have that, you have the brand of being a physical team. So then you say, okay, I'm going to give them leeway. That's just how they defend. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm looking for in a coach.
All right. Can I run something by you that I've struggled with recently since the coaching switch? I'm going to run something by you. And I want your honest reaction to this. You could tell me I'm full of it. You could tell me I am hitting the mark dead on. But the differences between Taylor Jenkins and Tomas Isolo's offense, obviously a lot more high pick and roll, trying to get Ja going, mm-hmm. trying to get Zach Edey going. We understand the differences. I think they've gone from 13 screens a game with Zach Edey to 30. I mean, it's stark. My eyes, every night since Isolo has taken over, tell me that his offense looks better than Taylor Jenkins did. The stats say it's very similar. And I feel like my eyes are lying to me to a certain extent, Parker. And the reason I say that is because my eyes are taking in Ja Morant getting 30 points per game since Tomas Isolo is taking over. It's not maximizing the rest of the bench and the rest of the players on the roster like with Taylor Jenkins. So there's some give and take to that. It's more pleasing on the eye because Ja is absolutely getting after it and they're playing to his strengths. But at the same time, the numbers tell you it is about the same. There's no real difference, no substantive difference between what Taylor Jenkins was doing and what Tomas Isolo has been doing in regards to what the numbers actually tell you. So I feel like my eyes tell me it looks better, but I feel like my eyes are lying to me. Am I crazy for having that thought?
I don't think you're crazy for having that thought, no. Because like you kind of hit the nail on the head, obviously. Getting Ja going is what's going to maximize your team's ceiling because he is a guy that's capable of taking over a series as the best player in the series because we have that evidence of him doing so. But you can also point to like, hey, when Taylor Jenkins was here, you know, you got more production out of Santi Aldama and Luke Kennard because the ball was in their hands a little bit more and they were able to get into a rhythm and find their shots. And also, too, I think one thing that could also be deceiving is, like, before Taylor Jenkins was fired, Ja Morant was in a big shooting slump, and now he's shooting the ball well, you know? I do think it's, like, a kind of – again, Easley even said, there's not a lot of time to change things, maybe other than just, like, the more frequent pick and roll. Maybe, like, that's also, like, part of the wash where it's, like, okay, we can't quite judge it like this, but right. I don't know. It's a very good thought-provoking question because I mean, I kind of look at it. It's like I would say maybe where your eyes aren't lying. It's like there's those fewer moments because they're a ball transfer. Because remember, there'd be instances where they would drive, and a player would stop near like the elbow or something, and like kind of pivot and look for the next spot to pass because there wasn't that ball screen to allow for space. They're waiting for all the cutting. That's where I'm like, okay, there is a little bit more fluidity with the offense, but also at the same time, they're driving and kicking a lot less frequently, which is also why guys like Tatsuya Adama, Luke Kennard are not getting the looks that they had been getting before the coaching change and why they have struggled since the coaching change.
Right. I think the frustrating thing, too, is like we've always talked about, me and you and Connor, we have been talking about it all year when there's been conversations about not enough ball screens, too many ball screens, equal opportunity offense sucks, you know, we're not maximizing job, all of these different sort of thoughts and narratives that have been created this year. We've always said, okay, there needs to be a melding. As much as I have enjoyed Tomas Isolo and the way Ja's been playing under him, the way Zach Edey's been playing under him, this has not been a melding. This has been 0 to 100. Let's run as many ball screens as possible. Like I said, the stat that just jumps off the page is Zach Edey was setting 13 ball screens per game when he was playing under Taylor Jenkins. It's now up to 30. I mean, it's not necessarily what I would call a melding of the two thought processes.
Yeah, that's fair. And also you could point to, like, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but like, those Jaren ISOs aren't as frequent as they were before.
Right.
And you can argue like that's very transformative to the Grizzlies upside, because Jaren, with him toggling between the four and the five, he provides so many mismatch opportunities. And again, identifying competitive advantages, because it's, hey, he's too big for a lot of these fours. He's going to, you know, let's clear it out, give him an empty corner to work with. We're going to back this smaller guy on the post. We're going to try to draw this double. Hey, maybe let's even put Luke Kennard or Desmond Bane a pass away, so that the guy that's a pass away tries to double Jaren. Next thing you know, you have an open three from a 40%+ 3-point shooter. Or it's, hey, Jaren's the five. We have all this space around him. Let's clear it out. He's going to go take Drew Eubanks or Yusuf Nurkic off the dribble and get to the basket every single time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing I've kind of noticed. But again, that could also be attributed to the ankle, too.
Yep, for sure. Now, I want to switch the subject before I let you roll. Did you enjoy Wednesday night watching Luka go drop 45 on the Dallas Mavericks' head, then get a standing O from the opposing team after he just killed him? I mean, that was fun, but
beautiful.
Also, I will say this. Every time I see Nico Harrison's stupid face up on the screen, it enrages me. It enrages me. And I think most people that are fans of other Western Conference teams feel the same way.
Yeah, because, yeah, it's infuriating. But also, I kind of feel bad for this instance of, like, they're chanting fire Nico at, like, while one of their players at the free throw line, where it's like, dude, Max Christie was in the trade. He's 22 years old. Like,
he didn't do anything wrong.
And he missed those free throws, too. I'm like, dude, just stop. Like, this is Max
I get
Christie.
It.
Like, I don't know, man. But, no. I loved seeing Luka just wreak absolute havoc. I mean, Luka when he's on is one of the most fun players to watch in the league.
Yeah,
he is beautiful.
With Nico getting a lot of hate, I think there's one guy in particular that's like swerving a little bit too much of it. Patrick Dumont, the new governor. I feel like everybody he's on the back burner. People don't really pay attention to the fact that he's the one who had to ultimately say yes to Nico. And he gave reasons that made no sense, saying Shaq was like the epitome of off-season health and workmanlike attitude. But yeah, people ignore that. I'm not saying Nico's a scapegoat. I know that's a popular thing to say on social media right now. But Patrick Dumont deserves a lot of criticism in this situation as well. The new owner syndrome is real.
Yeah, like, because let's be real. Mark Cuban went in and signed off on that trade.
Absolutely Luka, not.
Or Mark Cuban was on record for saying he would divorce his wife before he trades Luka Doncic. it's mind-boggling.
It is. It very much is. But we'll see how the Grizzlies fare tonight against the Nuggets. I'll say this, though, Parker. You have a good weekend regardless of how this game goes tonight.
I think I will. I will have a good weekend regardless. I appreciate it, Gabe. I hope you do, too.
Yes, sir. Appreciate it, Parker. That is Parker Fleming at @Paka_Flocka on X. Make sure you go subscribe to his free Grizzlies and NBA draft Substack called Substack Elitist. If you give monetary support, it goes directly to St. Jude because he is a grade A human being. Now let's go ahead and pivot. We'll go ahead and get to the Blitz. And coming up next, I'll give you my take on the Nico Aimaleava situation. I got to be the first to recognize and welcome George Ruggiero, King George, to the Blitz. First time, I believe. First time, maybe second time, something like that.
Come on down.
I'm glad to have you.
There was about a month where I did it with Connor.
Oh, yeah, true. I was out. There's a reason I don't remember those.
Tennessee's quarterback. Let's talk about it.
Okay, Tennessee quarterback Nico. There is a lot to break down here and some half-truths, some full-truths, some lying going on. Let's start from the beginning. Yesterday, On Three's Pete Nakos, who covers college football recruiting for them, mentioned that Nico Iamaleava was looking for a new NIL deal from Tennessee. Last year, it has been reported that he made between $2.2 to $2.5 million. He wants to get upwards of $4 million. So he went back to the negotiating table to talk with Josh Heupel and company, talk to the NIL people about getting more money. So that report was published. After that, Nico Iamaleava's father, who is very big on Twitter, comes out, and here is the tweet. I'll read it, and I'll bleep out what I need to. More games being played off the field than on the field. B. Nakos, talking about Pete Nakos, he called him a B-word, from On3 Sports, called and asked me directly. I told him I had no idea what he's talking about. He said his close source that he trusts with his life from the University of Tennessee staff gave him this information. So y'all can ask them what's going on, because it ain't from us. Now, after Nico Iamaleava's father tweeted this out to completely try to nullify Pete Nakos' report, it is being reported from Tennessee sources that Nico Iamaleava is not on the practice field today. So, if I'm using my brain, Pete Nakos, likely correct. Most of the On3 people have come to his rescue and said, I'm not going to nullify this report because it is correct. Nico Iamaleava is very clearly trying to get more money out of Tennessee before the season gets going. All right. Now that we have all that out of the way,
where do we begin?
I tend to have a little bit of an issue with Nico Iamaleava after his freshman year, or redshirt freshman year, asking for more money. He was really, if you look at the numbers, a bottom half quarterback in the SEC. That doesn't mean he doesn't have a bunch of talent. He's 6'6", 225 pounds. He's got legs. He can run. He's got a cannon for an arm. But he ain't Hendon Hooker. He didn't give you that last year. When you look at what he did in the bowl game, in the playoff against Ohio State, he left, let's just say, a lot to be desired. He threw for 104 yards on 31 pass attempts against the eventual champion Ohio State Buckeyes. If you're making $2.2 to $2.5 million, it feels like that should be enough. If you have a multi-year contract, should be enough. You probably shouldn't be going back to Tennessee after the season you had and the end of the season that you had and be asking for more money. I understand the market's the market. I get that quarterbacks are generally hard to come by. But all of this theater, all of this nonsense is too much when you compare it and put it side by side with the play that Nico Iamaleava gave you last year. If we're being honest about Tennessee's offense a year ago, it was Dylan Sampson doing most of the work, and that defense stepped up in a big way to make that team into a playoff team. Nico Iamaleava had some good games, he had some good moments, and I think he could have some good games and good moments going forward. But for him to step up after the year he had last year and think he has the bargaining chips to ask for $2 million more dollars, I think is a big symptom of the problem that we see in college athletics right now. There should be no entitlement when you played the season the way you did last year. You should understand that you have to go back to the drawing board. You have to play a better season to ask for that type of money. It's just a lot of nonsense. I don't know how it figures itself out. I will say this. I think if Tennessee got into a situation where Nico got into the transfer portal and left because these negotiations faltered and ended, I think they could go find another quarterback out on the open market and get him ready for fall camp and get him ready for the season. May not get the exact same results, but I think I have the you know, confidence that Josh Heupel and his offense could attract another big name quarterback to that program with the money they have at their disposal. Someone, probably pretty good, will pay for $2.2 to $2.5 million per year and not come back to the table after the year, after a bad season, and ask for more money. So those are my overarching thoughts about this whole thing. It's nonsense, though.
It absolutely is nonsense. I think it's insane. And I think the biggest thing that you brought up is if we're essentially paying players, which it's not essentially, we are paying players now, you also pay them to produce. He didn't produce like a $4 million quarterback.
He didn't produce like a $2.5 million quarterback, which is what he got paid. Let's be honest. Like, can we be honest about the situation?
Yeah.
Like, when
Connor's not here. The Tennessee guy's not here.
And he would agree with it.
I know he would. I know.
But in the NFL, if you want more money, you have to produce. You have to go out of your way to put up good statistics, to lead your team to the promised land, to win some playoff games, do things like that. Nico didn't do that. He didn't do it at a very high level. Like, this is not how contract negotiations go in any walk of life. Yet he's still stepping up to the table and asking for money. I don't understand it. And I also don't understand why his dad wants to be, quite frankly, an a-hole to the people reporting what is, in all likelihood, the correct news. The correct thing to be reporting right now.
You know what the funny part about that is? The fact that Pete reports it, right? That goes viral. That hits the internet. We get a response from the dad, who, as far as we know, is involved, but, you know, maybe not, you know, an agent type of involved. And then it's reported by the same people. Man, Nico's not at practice today. What's going on with that?
Without fail.
Get proven wrong. It's insane.
It's bad. I don't envy the situation that Tennessee's in right now. You're in spring practice. It's not easy to turn around the quarterback position if you feel like Nico's going to get into the transfer portal. But from what I'm hearing, and I agree with Tennessee on this, they're not going to budge.
That's what I've heard.
I don't think they're just going to up him to $4 million to keep him on the roster. They're going to say, we're giving you $2.5 million. If you want more money, go be a Heisman candidate this year. $2.5 million is more than enough to you know, satisfy your monetary appetite going into the 25-26 season. I don't think I need to give you more than that. So I think Tennessee's doing the right thing, and it feels like Nico Amleava, his agency, and his dad are certainly doing the not-so-right thing, we'll say. The not-so-right thing.
Tanner Toulson joins Abde Bashir and others who have now exited the list of potential transfer players for the Memphis Tigers basketball team. Concern level on the lack of movement for the Tigers in the transfer portal.
Okay. I want to echo the sentiments I've been echoing for just basically the past week. They only have one transfer portal commit in Quante Berry. I think it's a good transfer portal commit as long as you keep PJ Haggerty on the roster, which will take most of your NIL budget, $2 million, $3 million, whatever it is. I think you have to split your concern into two different camps. One is the short-term this season or this upcoming season concern. Not that concerned about Penny Hardaway building a roster. He can go get talent. Him and Nolan Smith have more than enough ties in the AAU circuit. They have more than enough ties to other guys around the country to field a very competitive top of the AAC roster like they had this year. So, like, short-term, no real concern. I think they have enough money at their disposal to make something happen. And whether it's late in the calendar or earlier in the calendar, I think it'll get done. So short-term concern, let's get that out of the way. Not worried. Penny Hardaway's a player getter. He'll figure it out. Long-term, totally different discussion. Totally different discussion. And it goes back to what I've been saying all week. You saw JT Toppin stay at Texas Tech after getting in the transfer portal for a $4 million payday. Memphis can give someone $4 million, but then they may only have $2 million to fill out the rest of the roster with 7, 8, 9 players. That's a problem. Texas Tech, know what they can do? Yeah, they may have a budget, but
They got oil money.
That oil guy that you don't even know the name of, if they want a player, they're like, this guy's asking for like $850,000. You think he could cough that up? And that guy pulls that money out of his back pocket, out of his sock, and hands it to them. You can't do that at Memphis. And also, with rev sharing on the way, a place like Texas Tech's going to offer $20 million to their players per year across all sports. Memphis and the AAC, they have a minimum, sure, 3 years, $10 million to their players. But that pales in comparison to the every year $20 million that all of the Power Four schools are going to offer up to their players. So the divide, while it's always been there, keeps widening. And that's my concern. It's all long-term, short-term, missing out on Abdi Bashir and Tanner Toulson and guys like that. I'm not that worried. I think they can figure it out this offseason. But next offseason, the offseason after that, the offseason after that, that's where it starts to kick in. That's where I get concerned. As soon as this house settlement goes through, I think most of my concerns go up to a million, 100, whatever the hell you want, whatever number you think is correct for that. But that's where I'm at right now. This year, fine. I think he'll figure it out. Him and Nolan Smith, that staff. But going into the future, it's just going to be tougher and tougher.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily concerned, especially when we're looking at it being Penny Hardaway, of all people, who's done a very good job team building, at the very least, excuse me, roster building.
Yes.
Because we've had his teams in the past where they've been a great team, maybe not the best roster to work together.
Like program building is the way I would put it. He has not succeeded at that at a very high level in the past. I thought this past season, though, he did a good job.
Made a huge step forward, did a great job this past season. So I'm also not concerned about Penny being able to bring players in that sense. And especially, hopefully, guys that you're able to keep for more than 1 year. I think that's going to probably be part of the formula for mid-major schools, which I hate to say that about Memphis, but look at the conference that they're in.
The AAC.
They're in the AAC.
It's like, can we put that to bed, by the way?
Yes.
Memphis, as a program, does not operate as a mid-major, but they are, by definition,
a mid-major. Yes.
Just want to clear that out of there.
So in that sense, for the future probability of those schools continuing to compete in D1 period, it's going to be on the back of freshmen and guys that they're able to bring in and hopefully keep and develop for more than one season.
That's even harder.
Emphasis is hopefully.
Hopefully. So I will say, I think if you're talking about a concern level for other guys that they're targeting in the transfer portal going elsewhere this year, I don't think you need to have some massive concern about it. But the future is changing. Everything by the day is changing, and it's not going to be easy by the time we get there. So just keep that in mind. Keep that in mind as we continue to progress through this offseason. Now, we're going to continue to progress on this show. And we only have one more segment left in the day, one more segment left in the week right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show. It's going to be the Rewind when we return.